The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
The so-called war of choice against Iran that the United States began with Israel has morphed into something else. Inevitably, following the law of unintended consequences, Trump now has to either extricate himself against a background of escalating prices, inflation, and the possibility of a global recession, or double down and continue the war to save his own face and his presidency. But how could Trump, how could the Pentagon have overlooked the likely closure of the Strait of Hormuz and the targeting by Iran of oil and gas assets in those Gulf states which host the United States military? How critical is the Gulf production of oil and natural gas to the world's economy? And are there others who might pick up the slack? Now, to explore all of this, I'm joined by Ed Conway, author of a brilliant book called Material World, about the world's unending search for raw materials and the complex supply chains. Good morning, Ed, and welcome.
Hi, Pat. How are you?
I'm very well. Now, can you, as we speak, tell us how degraded are the oil and gas production facilities all around the Gulf?
In a sense, there's kind of two things going on at the same time. First of all, there's the fact that you can't get the oil out, or indeed the liquefied natural gas. So that's the Strait of Hormuz issue, which is that, you know, even though there's a few pipelines running around the place, basically, pretty much all of the oil, basically all of the liquefied natural gas has to go out via the straits. And given the straits are closed, you can't get that. So that's one half of it. The other half is that the actual facilities themselves have been under attack. And there are two, that I kind of fixate on a lot just because there is nowhere else on the planet that is as important for our energy. And that's in this case, that's not hyperbole. It's like, this is just straightforwardly the situation. One of them is Ras Tanura, which is basically it's the point at where all of Saudi's oil gets loaded onto tankers. It's a big terminal. That place has been shut down because they were facing missile attacks. And then the other one is Ras Laffan, which is just on the kind of nape of Qatar, just in the north of Qatar, which is kind of this peninsula. And it's a gas terminal. And basically what they do there is they suck up all of the gas from what's known as the North Field, which is this big underground field right in the middle of the Persian Gulf. So it's kind of under the water. And they turn it into liquefied natural gas. And those two places, there is nowhere else on the planet that is as important in terms of like a concentrated place where energy is collected than those two places. And they are both kind of out of just not operational right now. And the thing that's most worrying from the past few days is there have been missile attacks on Ras Laffan, which mean that it's going to take potentially years. I mean, the people there, Qatar Energy, talking about it taking years for it to be back up to, you know, operational how it was before, which is the concern. It's like, even if you have a best case scenario now and the strait reopens and then shipping starts and the fighting ends, you still have this scar that's going to be hanging over the global economy for quite some time when they, you know, they have to make repairs.
Now, you talk about the storage problem. It's not as if you can flick a switch and switch off production. Is that the issue? You can't stop your oil wells. You can't stop your gas production. You've got to store what comes out of the ground, which normally would go by shipping then on to the rest of the world. But with the strait closed and shipping can't move, what do you do with the stuff you're producing when your storage is full?
Well, that's part of the challenge. So we in Europe, we kind of think a lot about storage as, you know, we want to get lots of storage so that we have gas for a rainy day. The issue in the Gulf is they have a certain amount of storage, but for the most part, everything is just predicated on the notion that when the gas or oil comes out of the ground, it's loaded pretty quickly onto a tanker and then off it goes. And so they only have, it depends, you know, it varies by country, but they only have storage of a matter of days worth of that oil and gas, which is constantly kind of, you know, under high pressure, supposed to be coming out of the ground. And they've basically exhausted that storage. And that's why, you know, we've seen the stories in recent weeks of Kuwait, Iraq, to some extent the UAE as well, starting to reduce the amount of oil they're getting out of the ground. And the worrying thing for me about that, and it varies from well to well, is in some cases, when you kind of, there, like you say, there's no switching them off. There is no off switch. But when you basically stop pumping, then you can cause long-term damage to the oil reservoir. And it varies by place. But particularly in Iraq, some of those wells, there is a chance that First of all, it takes months to get back up and running again when you need to. So again, no switch. And secondly, there is a chance that some of them could be damaged for good and you just don't have the oil that you think you have. So it all comes back to this issue that there's longer term damage for every day and week that this goes on that we'll still be feeling for quite some time, sadly.
So these oil wells coming from the oil reservoirs deep in the geology are pumping out at a steady rate, and they all understand how that works. Then you stop it, and it may interfere with the geology and fracture various things well below ground.
Exactly.
Making the well unusable maybe going forward, or the reservoir unusable going forward.
Exactly, and that's kind of what's happened in Venezuela. So part of the reason Venezuela is struggling to get back up to where they were before, you know, massive oil country, is that they just stopped a lot of the pumping, and now a lot of that stuff is just damaged, it's broken, it's gone.
Now we'll come to the economic effects of the closure of the strait in a moment or two, but I want to talk about South Pars and the Israeli attack on South Par, and the idea that this was unprovoked, an Israeli solitary action without the say-so of the United States. What is the significance of that attack?
Well, South Pars, although it kind of obviously has a different name, it's basically the same gas field as the one that Qatar is tapping into. It's the same field, it just straddles the Persian Gulf. And so, you know, geography is very different to geology. Geology doesn't really understand political boundaries. But basically, they're just tapping their straws into the same big, and it is big. There is nowhere else on the planet in terms of a gas field that is as big as this. And what happened a few days ago was that Israel attacked the Iranian facilities. So it's kind of the Iranian counterpart of Ras Laffan. And the point they made is, look, you might think this is civilian, but actually it is what they call dual use. In other words, it also has military applications. And, you know, to be honest, you could say the same about any gas field anywhere in the world, because obviously one of the things that we kind of get from it is lots of gas that then it goes into power stations, that goes into, you know, homes for heating. So that's civilian. But then by the same token, actually quite a bit of gas is taken out of the ground and it's turned into ammonia. It's kind of a nitrogen-based fertilizer. Well, it's partly used for fertilizer, but it can just as easily be used as an explosive. And so it's entirely plausible and feasible that the gas that comes out of the ground in Iran is used to make explosives. Of course it will be. But then it's kind of the same thing over on the other side of the Persian Gulf. In every gas field everywhere in the world, including, you know, the ones that we used to have in Europe, we've been taking it out of the ground and turning it into fertilizer, which in turn is something that can be used as explosives. So it's awkward that the civilian and military aspects are quite kind of closely intertwined here. So drawing a line between them is not straightforward.
But is it more simplistic than that from Israel's point of view? If you degrade the Iranian ability to export and earn dollars or yuan or whatever currency they sell in, that you destroy their economy, whereas the Trump ideology would suggest we want to change the regime, we want to get a pro-Western government in Iran, and we want it to be prosperous because that's the way it'll stay friendly with us.
Yeah, well, a large part of Iran's economy is still completely dependent on oil and gas, so they have access to that field. And so, yeah, if you're going to be degrading those facilities, it is a hit on the Iranian economy. But it's worth saying at the same time, Iran, by closing the Strait of Hormuz, is also inflicting a massive hit on not just the world economy, that's the bit obviously we notice, but also its economy, because it can't get its oil and gas in and out as easily as it would otherwise have been able to do. So the two things are intertwined. Everyone is suffering. And at the moment, the funny thing about this period is it's kind of a question of what's your tolerance level for economic pain. And the tolerance level for economic pain clearly in Iran is incredibly high. Clearly in Israel, it's also incredibly high, because this is a battle that Israel has been kind of, you know, particularly Benjamin Netanyahu has been kind of waiting for a long time. The question is whether the rest of the world has a tolerance point for all of this. And we are all going to be affected by this, like it or not, unfortunately.
Now, the targeting of an oil refinery, an Israeli oil refinery at Haifa, how significant was that?
Well, Israel has become also kind of quite a big oil and gas producer in recent years. And I mean, what it underlines is the fact that very quickly, I mean, like startlingly quickly, this turned from being a military conflict into one that was very economic. It's very much both sides trying to target the energy kind of systems of each other. And I guess that comes from a recognition that without energy, then pretty much all economic activity, you know, and I think we've talked about this before, pretty much any economic activity is affected. All form of economic activity depends one way or another on energy. And when you cripple those systems, you're crippling a country's ability to just do anything. And it is, it's a lesson that I think we in Europe have kind of to some extent forgotten, but clearly, you know, in the Middle East, they are well aware of this. And that's why you've got Israel attacking, you know, Iran's energy facilities. Iran is attacking the energy facilities all around the Gulf, which has a kind of double, is a double-edged thing. It's partly we want to take you on, but also we want to show the world that no one should mess with Iran. And hence why, you know, we're in this depressing situation where economics people like me are trying to wrangle through what the consequences are, but struggling to, because it's just like, it is really incalculable at the moment. Yeah. And we just hope that it kind of, you know, improves in the coming weeks.
Netanyahu has said that his vision is to build pipelines that would bypass the Persian Gulf effectively, and they could export in that way. Is that feasible? I mean, it would be very long term. And I suspect pipelines, unless they were well buried, and even if they were well buried, they would be incredibly vulnerable to attack.
Yeah. They're targets that can't move. And you know, think about what happened with Nord Stream, that pipeline going from Russia through the Baltic into Europe, which was part destroyed. And the same thing can very easily happen. And that's one that's hard to get to, you know, because that's under the sea. Pipelines, if they were straddling, you know, coming up, for instance, from the kind of Euphrates region, so from Iraq, Kuwait, up towards Turkey. Well, there are old pipelines there, but they're just not really used much, partly because it is just so politically fraught in that area. And frankly, it will take many, many years to build something like that. And I think, this is one of the... You look at the region and think to yourself, God, why didn't they do something about this sooner? There are some pipelines going across Saudi Arabia, getting the oil that we're talking about from the Gulf side, because most of it is basically, again, just quirk of history and geology and geography. Most of it is on the kind of shoreline of the Persian Gulf with only one way in and out, and that's the Strait of Hormuz by water. There is a pipeline going across Saudi. It can only get some of the oil across. We might well reasonably ask, why on earth weren't there more pipelines built in the past? As if, you know, it's not as if this is a surprise. The Strait of Hormuz has for centuries been seen as this choke point where if it gets stopped up, then the rest of the world is in trouble. But yet here we are. There, like, somehow either people just didn't think this was going to happen. They miscalculated, or they just hope it'll be over quite soon.
Now, the question of the impact on various commodities around the world. I mean, anyone who gets a delivery at the local grocery store via a diesel-powered van, obviously the cost of that delivery will go up. The cost of producing food will go up in terms of fertilizer. Gone through the roof in the United States. I saw 77% increase in the price of fertilizer for the farmers in the Midwest. Maybe it's even higher than that now.
Yeah.
So the economic impacts will affect pretty much everything in your shopping basket.
Sadly, yes, because that's what happened, obviously, after 2022 when Russia invaded Ukraine. But it was quite concentrated on Europe, that particular crisis, because we were the continent that was at the end of lots of those pipelines coming from Russia. This time around, the impacts are far more widely spread around the world. But I think it does, you know, it's particularly bad for Europe. I mean, it is bad for Asia as well, and it's bad for China. Albeit that China has lots of other places that it buys oil and gas from. But it's bad for Europe just because we are a massive energy importer, and we are still a massive energy importer. And so whenever prices go up around the rest of the world, then we in Europe are affected by it because we are the buyer. We're at one end of that transaction, and we don't benefit from the rise in price. I mean, like, there's a few oil producers, obviously, in you know, kind of North Sea and UK and in Norway who do benefit. But for the most part, we're takers of those prices. And that means we are, as a continent, less well off than we were before. And then it's just a question of how do you deal with the distributional consequences? In other words, who is going to be paying for that? Is it going to be kind of poorer households? Is it going to be all households? And that, I think, is the awkward conversation that we're going to be wrestling with in the coming months when all the budgets are written about this. Like I say, let's just hope it's short-lived. There will still be some scarring for places like Ras Laffan. But there is, it's not impossible that it's not quite as disastrous as it might sound from this interview. But like right now, it doesn't look very promising.
Now, the other commodities that actually pass through the strait, helium. And, you know, we joke about helium. You suck it in and you develop a falsetto voice. That's a bit of fun. But yes, helium is used for the manufacture of silicon chips, for use in MRI scanners and in many other aspects of industry. What's going to stop working because we don't have helium?
Yes, and I say this as a kind of large consumer of helium because I have four young children and we have lots of kids' parties at my house. However, that being said, my you know, use of helium is tiny in comparison with the really important uses. So if you want to have, basically helium these days is used for a couple of things. First of all, it is really good at cooling. So if you want to kind of super refrigerate anything down to kind of absolute zero or close to absolute zero, so minus 270 or whatever it is, then you need to use helium. And the main, or one of the main uses for that is MRI scanners, as you say, because they've got like superconducting, super cooled magnets right at the heart of them. So if you want to run an MRI scanner, you need a supply of helium. And right now, the second biggest provider of global helium was Qatar. It was Ras Laffan. It's exactly this plant that I'm talking about. With that gone, we have a shortage. That's a problem for MRI scanners, but it's also a problem. The other use of helium is when you want to kind of take some sort of a container and remove all of the air and make it inert. Helium is pretty important as one of the gases for that. And so helium along with argon are used for that within semiconductor manufacturing. So at the same time as, you know, you've got hospitals struggling with the impact of this, you also will have semiconductor manufacturing places making silicon chips that go into phones, that go into computers, and also are used for AI. All of a sudden they have a problem, which is they have a shortage of this stuff. And I guess it just underlines that the world is very complex. And when you kind of knock out one little bit of the supply chain, in this case, it's a big bit of the supply chain and it's a very important supply chain, but even so, it's kind of one simple bit. You knock that out and then all of a sudden you spend the following months going, oh, I didn't realize that that was connected to that. Well, that's what we're living through now. And one would have hoped that having gone through it back in 2022, we might have some more wisdom about it. But I'm slightly depressed to say it doesn't look that way from the start.
Looking globally at the whole problem and the inability of the Gulf states to earn massive amounts of petrodollars if they cannot sell their wares, and they invest those petrodollars a lot of the time in America, what impact will there be there?
Well, I think it's bad for the Gulf in all sorts of respects. It's bad because, yes, they're not going to have as much in the way of petrodollars, although, you know, the price of the stuff that they can get out is far higher, but they're not pumping as much, so they're not going to be as wealthy. But I think the deeper issue for them is that, you know, if you think of places like Dubai, think of Qatar, think of Bahrain to an extent, they are basically kind of tax havens that have encouraged a lot of people from around the world, you know, including from our countries, to come there and work there, incentivized by low tax rates, and to try and set up a big services economy that so they can kind of shift away from oil and gas. That was the grand economic model for, including Saudi, for a lot of these places. Now, all of a sudden, that is all up in the air because a lot of people just wouldn't have reckoned on having to deal with air raid sirens and bombardments when they went to move it to Dubai. And therefore, can these countries, which are totally dependent on a massive migrant population, bigger than any other country, like serious country in the world, what does that do to them? It's existentially a massive challenge kind of for them. And then that in turn, I think, has knock-on consequences. But I've got to say, I clearly it is not good for any country. But of all of the countries in the world, America is probably like less directly affected by the economics than most. This is not to say it's not affected. And you know, gasoline prices, which is so, so politically contentious in America, they're already going up. So they are affected and they are plugged into the rest of it. However, America is now energy independent. It has, I mean, in terms of the amount of gas and oil that they pump out because of fracking, they have crazy amounts of oil, crazy amounts of gas. And so America is much more insulated from this than it was back in the 1970s. But that being said, like as we're discussing, it has global repercussions, and in all sorts of unexpected ways, it's likely to kind of rebound and redound, which I think Trump is very, very conscious of ahead of the midterms. And you can see him trying to kind of talk the oil price down, trying to do what he can. The problem, of course, as anyone who's read into the area will know, is that this is a hornet's nest. It's a Pandora's box. I mean, there's lots of metaphors. It's a Pandora's box. And you don't just kind of put these things back very easily, even in the best of circumstances. So have they miscalculated? I mean, certainly looks kind of very much in that direction at the moment.
Finally, Ed, I should ask you about the prediction that wars in the 21st century would end up primarily being about water, a supply of fresh water for everybody. Now, the Gulf states are particularly vulnerable. I mean, if Iran was to go totally rogue and start to take out desalination in the Gulf states, those places would become virtually unlivable. You'd be back to, you know, living around the oasis for fresh water.
Yeah, completely.
So where do we stand there? I mean, is this the next phase in this war?
Well, one hopes not, because then you're talking about the genuine life or death, and that is the life support for the region. I mean, there's an interesting history here, because actually, although there's very little water on the surface, there is actually quite a lot of aquifer water underneath many of these deserts. The problem is actually they've tapped a lot of that water, so their survival is increasingly kind of predicated on running desalination plants, which obviously takes a lot of energy. So again, they need to kind of pump the energy in there. But also, if they do get targeted, and then there have been some attacks on them on both sides, although, you know, it seems like they haven't been kind of as enthusiastically attacked. But if that is the next phase, then that's a very scary place to be, because, as you say, this is millions of people in an area that couldn't really sustain itself without water, and most of that water is desalinated.
Well, Ed, we talked before about your book, Material World, subtitled A Substantial Story of Our Past and Future, and covered everything from coal to lithium to oil. I suspect after this adventure or misadventure in the Middle East by Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, that you'll have to have a second edition rather soon.
Maybe. I mean, the weird thing is, among the places I visited when I was kind of, you know, doing the book was Ras Laffan. And I wrote a whole bit of the book saying, look, this place is incredibly important, but it is there in the shadow of kind of Iranian missiles at any given time, and Ras Tanura, these two places. And now it's kind of come true, but I'm not, you know, even if it adds one or two extra sales, it is so depressing that it is no cause for celebration, because these moments are not good for anyone, really.
Well, Ed, we shall be following your ongoing coverage in the Sunday Times as well. But thank you very much for joining us on the programme today.
Thanks, Pat.
The Pat Kenny Show, Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.